Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Business of Music podcast, where we teach you everything you need to know about owning and growing a music business. My name is Elliot Towsley, and my business partner James Landry and I are your hosts. Shoot us an email to contact@denovoagency.com so we can answer your questions on our next podcast. And to learn even more, subscribe to our YouTube channel and sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode of the Business of Music podcast. We are recording, and this is the Business of Music podcast. What is going on, everybody? I know I start this the exact same way every time, but I don't really know what else to do. My name is Elliot. That's my business partner, James. James, what's up, man?
Not much. It's a late night to be recording, but
it is.
We do have to come up with a new intro here.
We got to get started. We got to get a sound guy. We need like a third person so that like when we say something funny, someone goes like bing, 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 or it's like, something, you know?
Parks and Rec when they have the...
Maybe it's some one level up from that. That might be good. Or maybe if, you know, if we were comparing it to a Parks and Rec department of a perhaps Indianapolis, not Pawnee, maybe we might be in the right realm of things. But I guess, you know, one thing I did want to do today is, you know, we do this podcast pretty much completely on the fly. We don't have any notes. We might have a topic or two in mind that we want to discuss, but that's pretty much it. So one thing I did want to correct about something I said about Eddie Van Halen. I said that he immigrated from Germany as a guess, and that was incorrect. He was Dutch. And second, I said, I was trying to figure out what song of Michael Jackson's he did the, guitar solo on, and I had guessed, I don't remember what I guessed. Yeah. I guessed Billie Jean, but that is incorrect. It was Beat It. And there is a great story I actually found about that incident. When he went and recorded that solo for Michael Jackson on Beat It, it became an incident because this was like in the early 80s, mid 80s, I think. So like keep in mind, the technology back then was much different than it is now. He shredded a guitar solo so hard and so loud that the amp literally caught on fire. And like, it was like, oh shit. And they had to like, I mean, think about it. This was like probably one of the nicest studios in the world. It was Michael Jackson, Eddie Van Halen in the mid 80s. Like they were probably in the nicest, one of the nicest studios in the world. And Eddie Van Halen ripped a guitar solo so hard on Beat It that the fucking amp caught on fire. And that has got to be one of the coolest rock stories of all time.
I've never heard that before. That's
when this is over, go back and just listen to that solo on Beat It. And like, that's where that tapping technique that we had talked about, where like Eddie Van Halen was the first person to do that on an electric guitar. He really shines that technique on that song. And like right at the end where it goes like I think that's when the amp caught on fire. And like the rumor has it is that like they did it in like the one take, and like that one take blew up the amp, and they're like, well, we have to keep this take, of course, we can't not use this take, it lit the building on fire.
That's the only one.
We got to do that one. Yeah. And I mean, even so, there's no chance of recording after that. The amp is on fire, so he's done for that night.
One of my favorite stories that you always tell is McCartney in the Beatles and the drummer, Ringo.
Which one? Ringo
is a drummer.
Oh my goodness. Ringo is, so I love Ringo. Ringo is the man and a legend. And like people forget he had like two or three number one hits that he wrote and did on his own after the Beatles. But Ringo, what a character. He is like the most rudimentary, basic drummer.
Wasn't there an interview and they asked him what it felt like to be the number one drummer in the world?
Wait, what?
Well, didn't he have an interview? Someone interviewed them and they're like, how does it feel to be the number one?
Yeah. Yeah. So, in the height of the Beatles, they were doing this interview And some guy was asking the group, all four of them were there, and they were saying essentially like, well, so you guys are the biggest, most popular band in the world. Like, you guys are the biggest musicians in the world. Ringo, does that make you the best drummer in the world? And then like Paul McCartney leans over and just goes, he's not even the best drummer in the Beatles. There are stories of like the band would go in and do their like recording, and then like the drums would just like be slightly off. So like Ringo would be long gone and Paul McCartney would be like fixing the drums. And Ringo, he got in the Beatles in the first place because this guy named, I think his name is Pete Best. That guy fucked up big time. That's like the biggest whoopsie. That and the guy who like sold his 10% of Apple stock for $800 in like 1978. That guy and Pete Best are equal idiots. And literally lost out of billions of dollars, both of them. And Pete Best missed a couple practices or something, and then they knew Ringo from this. He was in a band that was also playing like at, you know, they would play there all the time at this place in Liverpool or something. And Ringo was like 2 years older than Paul and John, but they knew him and they were like, well, he's funny. We like him. I bet he can fill in. And so they asked him to fill in and they really liked it. Like right away, they were kind of like, hey, this guy gets it. Like he clicks. And just like that, they're like, well, we don't need, you know, the best drummer in the world. We just need a guy to keep the beat. And Ringo was like, I'll do it. And yeah, so Pete Best really fucked up because I'm telling you, like a 17-year-old kid who had been playing drums for 4 or 5 years could probably play like 80 or 90% of the Beatles songs now. And granted, like a lot of what they did at the time was new. So like he gets points for making it work and it being new. But like in terms of drumming technique, the Beatles of their entire discography literally had one drum solo, and it was on like the last song they ever did, and it was called The End. And I think later on they put together Let It Be, but the album Let It Be, but it wasn't really meant to be that album, but they ended up breaking up, so they kind of put it together after. But one of the last songs the Beatles ever recorded together was The End. And then, so imagine they're all like, you know what? This is literally, this is coming to an end. Ringo, you know what, man? We haven't given you any solos. Well, let's give them one right here. And it's just like, it's really good, but it's, yeah. So in terms of drum technique and like, and it just, I mean, that's not what the Beatles did. The Beatles weren't the Who, you know, they didn't need to have an amazing guitar solo and some amazing drum thing to get people to tune in. They were different. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so that is a funny story about Ringo and Eddie Van Halen and Pete Best. Let's not forget Pete Best fucked up royally by missing a rehearsal. Guys, so musicians, don't skip the little gigs, because the little gigs could lead to humongous opportunities. And not go, if you are Pete Best, what do you think he ended up doing? Like selling insurance in Montana or something? Like he made made 120K a year. I was doing all right. Yep. But the $4 billion I would have had in my pocket for being part of the Beatles and doing the most rudimentary drums ever, that would have been nice.
Like maybe he started his own band. He's still performing.
Covers Beatles songs in Montana.
It's like that Uber driver we had in LA that one time who dressed up as a Beatle and did cover songs. That right. Pete Best could do that. He could just be one of those guys.
Maybe the band is Pete and the Best. And they're just doing like
he dresses a bunch up of, like Ringo.
Right, from Sgt. Pepper's. Well, and I like that clip on Facebook on Family Guy. They go to one of their cutscenes is like the Beatles, and Paul, John, and George are like down in a basement or something, and Ringo comes running down, and he's like, "Guys, I wrote a song. I finally wrote a song. And then they're all like being kind of like condescending and like, oh, nice, Ringo. You finally wrote one. Look, here, we're going to put it right on the fridge. And they put it on the fridge for him. And he's like, yeah, yeah. But like, man, more props to Ringo because he never let it bother him. And he was like, they picked me, man. Word, I'm in. I'll take the money.
Yeah.
What else we have going on? What's going on right now nowadays? We just talked, so I feel like...
Yeah, we just talked. So this is kind of a special episode. And the reason we're doing this on a late night here is because our guest is on the West Coast. And I think he's a really interesting guest. His name is Aaron Mattis. And he is an audio engineer. I was thinking today of how I wanted to like phrase who he is. Because audio engineers aren't... It's not the sexy job, right? No casual listener knows who you are. And I was actually thinking today that maybe the artists don't even know who he is. Because if you're in a big, like Universal or Atlantic Records, like the record might be recorded somewhere, then they give it to the engineer, and then they give it to the mastering guy. The artist might not have any idea. And that's something I wanted to talk to him about. But Aaron, I think he's probably in the top 1% of audio engineers in the world. I was really trying to think about it. I really think that is like, that's an easy statement. He's done hundreds of records. I was just going over it with James. Let's give the list of just who he's worked with recently. He has worked with ASAP Rocky, Super Duper Kyle, that guy, St. John, Brian Manuel, Rich Brian, whoever that is. He's got 4 million followers on Instagram. Labyrinth, who does one of my favorite well-written songs of all time, Jealous. That is such a fucking good song. Go listen to Jealous by Labyrinth if you're not having a good day. he's also done mixing for Max, that guy who out of New York. You might recognize him, but he's also done Hunter Hayes, Louth. So long story short, this guy has done a lot of mixing for a lot of different artists. And I think it's really worth it for our audience for us to get together here tonight and see what he has to say and see what kind of tips he can offer on if you're mixing your records at home. And I want to see, like, not necessarily his sales pitch, but like, why? What is the difference between like doing it at your house and going to a nice studio? Like, what is in that $300, whatever? Like, and you know, I'm interested to hear because I almost view engineers as like mechanics of a car. Like, yeah, I can see if the car is nice and if I like driving the car, but I don't know what made it run smoothly. I don't know what makes the turbo work. I just know it has one. He's kind of doing the things under the hood. And I want to hear his take on like if engineers or if musicians, is it worth skipping that step to save what nowadays is affordable? Like he's one of the best engineers in the world. And when I was working, he and I did maybe 20 songs together. And like, for those who don't know, I was a musician for a while and like my music is okay, but I really like the process and like learning how to market it and learning these things from Aaron. So like when I worked with Aaron, I used to do my own mixing and recording from home and it would sound okay. And like, I know we were talking about this the last episode with Brody. He was the engineer I was referring to when I was like, oh yeah, the first time I went to a professional engineer and really saw what he was doing, even if it was only to save time. This guy had every shortcut imaginable down. He was like a wizard. He knew exactly what he wanted to do with it. And he made it sound good. So not only did he save time, but he made the quality sound so much better. And it was one of those things where immediately I was like, wow, this guy knows what he's doing. Because I thought I knew what I was doing. Then this guy, I was like, oh shit. He really knows what he's doing.
He's the type of guy that we tell people like, look, go to a professional. There's a difference. And even if you guys don't think there is, working with someone like him or or another guest we'll bring on eventually, Landis, for example, working with someone like them compared to just using one of those auto master tools that's online for like 20 bucks, the difference is incredible. Even if you think you know, like if you produce, you do everything yourself, giving it to someone like him makes, like the first time you'll do it, I pretty much guarantee you'll never not do it after that.
Yeah. Well, it's exactly right.
Almost.
Well, you're exactly right, because as a musician, you're very meticulous about like how your sound, your song sounds. And you're exactly right. Once you go and you get that finished product, it's hard to go away. It's just the same as it. I always bring up the example of selling hoodies. It's like if one time you go to a guy who manufactures the hoodie you want to make, and the first one he gives you is, you can feel it. Wow, this is really high quality, but like this is exactly like, you can't then, even if it costs more, you can't then go back to some shitty version, because you know what the best of your product could be. And then that's why like so much of what we preach is through example or through practice. Like I tell you to focus on one song at a time and focus on your old music first, because I made 17 songs in a really, really nice really, really nice studio and spent a ton of money on mixing, mastering, and getting it all done. And I didn't think about how to market it after. And I put out a whole album and it all went to nothing. And if I had learned how to string this out, and it would have, I had 17 songs or something, it would have been better to have seven that were really, really good and promote the hell out of them than it would be to have 17.
Even if you took those 17 and promoted them, released one at a time, when you had the money to put behind it. It doesn't even have to be every 2 weeks or 3 weeks. No one knows. If you released one this week and you had money next week, cool. Number two, and then didn't have money for 7 weeks, put out number three. And what you're doing is creating the background and preparing so that when you do have the audience, you can release an album later on to people who actually care. And really, I don't know if I've talked about this recently, but albums aren't what they used to be. Albums used to be something that labels made because it was cheaper to get a lot of music on a CD and have to ship it out. You don't want to release one CD at a time and ship it out, and people don't want to buy and risk it every time. So they'd rather buy an album with 30 songs and hope they like five.
Right.
Labels would rather sell an album because they could put 30 songs on it, and that's easy. That's get as many as you can on an album. Compared to now, we're really in a singles and EP world where they're not selling physical copies. There's no overhead to store it. It's no different than selling sweatshirts is what selling CDs was. It takes up space. It costs money. Mm-hmm. And you have to buy shelving space in these stores. And
you have to produce the product.
Yeah, and you have to make
so
it.
First you get the audio file. Right, yeah.
CD Baby was such a big deal because they made the product. They're not doing that anymore. No one's doing that anymore. And so albums became a thing. People want an album. Oh, it's my first album. It's not the same anymore. I guess within 5 years, everyone who signs a record deal is going to sign to a certain number of songs, not a certain number of albums.
One, do you think it will be an amount of time? Not because your singles are getting shorter.
They're getting shorter. I don't think, but like, this is
we want 4 hours worth of music, recorded music.
Because the issue with that is, okay, I'm going to make a song like Pink Floyd, the medley.
Yeah, right.
There you go. I've got 4 hours of music right there. What they're going to do is it's going to be a number of songs in total. They're not going to, and obviously they have final say on in terms of when you release, how many you release at once, stuff like that. There will be a requirement on albums, but it's not going to be like it is now. Right now, albums, they pretty much have minimums. Everyone signs these deals and like, nope, it's we need 20 songs on album or 18 songs on album. It has to run for 2 hours and 30 minutes, 2 to 2.5.
Kind of like a movie.
Yeah.
It's got to be at least 90 minutes. These
deals are like it's what we're going to see the industry go to is you're going to sign a deal. It's going to be 400 songs over the course of 5 years. If you don't hit it, it automatically extends to another 2 years or 3 years. And it's going to make you, it's very easy to rush an album out. It's a lot harder to rush out singles and get them approved. And right. So right now, Now, what you used to see is an album would have one or two hit songs, I'd say. So if you switch over to a singles world, you're not going to be able to rely on one or two hit songs because they're going to want something good every time. And labels are going to shift to that because they're going to get more value from these artists who sign than an album. Signing for seven albums over the course of 5 years or 8 years is not much. Record labels make money, but they can make a lot more money requiring you to release one song every 2 months over the next course of 8 years with their final approval and budgeting everything. And it also costs less money. Clearing one song is a lot easier than clearing 20 to get it out. I wouldn't be surprised at time. I'm sure there's time requirements. There's time requirements now. It would be interesting. I bet you someone out there will have a contract that says, 400 total minutes of released music.
Mm-hmm.
But it'll also say like it has to be at least this many songs too. That way it's not just, here's two songs, 200 minutes a piece.
Right. Yeah, right. Well, and the thing like I want to wrap it back to is as the independent artist, if you're caught between, okay, well, I can either like do 15 songs on my own, or I can do 8 and have somebody professional mix and master them, do that. I can almost guarantee that doing the 7 or 8 professionally will be more beneficial to you than having 15 done okay. And I think one last thing, even if you are a good engineer and you mix your stuff, it's valuable to have a third party, a third set of ears or a second set of ears do the mastering, because just like writing an essay, you want to have somebody else proofread it, because you're just so used to your words and your voice that you might miss that little thing that somebody else, just because it's a different set of eyes, will see it right away.
Yeah, and I would also say it costs money to be successful in the industry. And that's what we always say. People sign record labels because it costs money. Don't try to get 8 full songs mixed mastered with a video for each and a budget to promote each all up front. You'll never release your music. That's asking to save a lot of money. The reports are right now that record labels for a album average between, for a low end, $100,000 to $250,000 on a marketing budget to promote a full album. So if you're releasing an album, realize it's going to cost a lot of money to promote the whole thing. Even if you were trying to do it for $500 a song, it gets expensive, because an album, even at 10 songs, that's at $5,000 all of a sudden. So think about
after making the songs.
Yeah, just to market it.
Right.
So
that's where Tony and I fucked up.
Yeah, artists need to think about the full budget for a song includes marketing. It also includes mixing and mastering. Don't do it cheaply and then put a lot of money into marketing. Like make it, it's a full recipe, your business. That would be like hiring a cheap chef at a new restaurant and then marketing the hell out of it. It's not going to matter if you get them there once because they're not coming back.
Yep. Now that's perfect segue into what I wanted to say. Just like a business, your music, your goal should be, how do I get this person to listen twice? Not once. How do I get this person to want to come and listen to me without seeing an advertisement? And even if you have an amazing marketing strategy and you can get eyes and ears on your product, if the product then isn't high quality. And the thing was, you know, I always fucked up because I was like, well, the lyrics are really, really good. The song, the idea of the song is really good. The mastering, what, it doesn't matter, because the song is will carry it. Nope. And like if Bohemian Rhapsody was recorded on an iPhone, you'd be like, what the fuck is this? Right? But it's cool in the headphones, and that might not be the best example, but you get the idea. And I would love to hear Aaron's take on this, because he would, I'm sure he would agree, it's better to have 3 or 4 really, really, really great sounding songs than it is to have 30 songs that sound okay or decent?
We can ask them.
Well, so what we're going to do is we're going to take a little break. We're going to get a word from Songflower, and then we're going to come back and have Aaron Mattis, the engineer, top 1% engineer, my guess, in the world. We'll see what he says right after this.
If you are an independent recording artist, we know that you're fed up with unnecessary fees and giving away your royalties to a music distributor. Songflower introduces lifetime distribution, the most artist-friendly way to release music. It's just $10 for a single, $20 for an EP, and $30 for an album to have Songflower distribute your music for life to all of the streaming platforms that you need to be on. Songflower never charges you any upgrades or hidden fees, and they will never take one penny of your royalties. Check out songflower.com to see why lifetime distribution is the right move for you and your music business.
So, dude, how you doing?
Good. Just, you know, getting started now.
Getting your day started. Yep. That's right. Yeah. I like that. You have like the work schedule of a vampire.
Yeah, I do, man. I'm sleeping. I get up before noon usually, and I'm working all night till the sun come up. But
right. Imagine coming back to the East Coast now. Yeah, by like 3 p.m.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Where you guys at now?
I'm in Florida, and he's in Charlotte, North Carolina. I like how I just say Florida. The whole fucking state of Florida. I'm in Florida.
The whole state. I like it.
The whole state.
It's
been a while.
I had to get out of the Northeast and get out of the cold and come down to Carolina here, at least for a little bit.
I feel it. I can't.
When did you send it out to California?
It was January 2019. It's almost 2 years.
That's right. Okay. And okay. So, well, we've been, obviously you weren't with us before. We've been talking here for a little bit, and I've been kind of prefacing, you know, who you are. And what I said was, I think that I'm very comfortable saying that you are you're an engineer who's in the top 1% of their field. Would you agree with that? Like, I mean, think about it, break it down. Cause I mean, and I was given a list here just on your Instagram. I saw like you had posted a couple pictures of like, you know, who I've worked with recently. And there was like ASAP Rocky, Hunter Hayes, like Kyle, like the super duper Kyle, like lots of artists. So what I wanted to do was just give you a chance to kind of tell us like a little bit about you and what it is you do and where you do it, so that I think so we can help our audience kind of understand, you know, what makes a good engineer, why is it worth paying for a good one? And I kind of gave my take from the musician side where I thought it's better to have, you know, 5 or 7 amazing sounding songs than to have 15 okay ones. And I'm talking a lot, so let's give the floor to you. And yeah.
Yeah. I agree with you. Definitely like, quality over quantity for sure. At the same time, I think depending on the artist, sometimes it's their process just to like bang out songs after song and see which one hits, but they're not always the best that way. But yeah, as an engineer, I mean, so yeah, I've been out here almost 2 years in LA. It was a little bit of a hard start. Making a move from Boston after, you know, being very comfortable there and making decent money, you know, engineering. But, you know, I wanted to progress a little more, and I felt like I was hitting the ceiling in Boston. So I had to come out here and just kind of, you know, take a backward step to move forward a little bit. And so, yeah, it was a little, you know, rough start at first, but made it through. And yeah, I got hired at Atlantic and Warner, and that just like opened doors for everything. You know, I met a lot of artists, a lot of A&Rs, a lot of producers, and yeah, I kind of just moved on to being able to mix a lot of great records. And yeah, so I guess as an engineer though, as a mixer at least, And I've learned a lot over the years and to get to where I'm at. And I think the best thing I've learned is, you know, when to use specific techniques or whatever. You know, you don't always need to throw everything at the song, you know, every little trick up your sleeve. I think an experienced engineer knows when to use this or when to not use this kind of thing.
I think that's a really key point, because we were talking to a producer the other day and they made a great point about, like, it very similar. You know, some producers want to throw the kitchen sink at a beat to show, look at everything I can do. And I think some producers and maybe some engineers in the same way kind of lose sight that it's, whether you like it or not, it's about the artist. And like, you've got to make the artist shine. Mm-hmm. Now, are there times where, what is it like for you when an artist is dead set on wanting to do something that, you know, just like isn't the right thing to do? And like, at what point do you just kind of say, all right, if that's what you want, sure, here you go, boop, boop. Or do you kind of just try to be like, hey, you know, maybe do this? Or are you there to be like, all right, if that's what you want, boom.
Yeah. I mean, I try and let them know if there's a better way to do it, and even give them some options. Sometimes there's just no way getting around it, and you gotta do what they want. Luckily, you know, I think as you start working with higher caliber artists, like when you work with them more frequently and you build a relationship with them, they begin to trust you. And even though they might not agree with it, at least they'll sit there and listen to it, listen to your idea. And sometimes you just gotta like trick them and do something.
Yeah, right. A little psychology and like a little magic trick.
I definitely feel like a psychologist in the studio sometimes, and you know, give them something that's they think it's the same, or I don't know. It can be tricky. So it kind of depends on the situation.
So it's almost like a little Jedi mind trick of like Inception, make them think that they thought of it. And you're like, yes, that's right. No echo there.
Yeah. So it's interesting, like working with different artists and the A&Rs and the producers, cause they all want their say in it. Knowing just when to like, or, you know, not come at them directly with your idea sometimes, kind of come at them on a sideways, you know, when you know it's going to be better this way. Just give them the options. So,
right. Well, and you said something so key is like the relationship with the person, like client number one and client number two. Client number one, you might be able to say, hey, dude, you're being an idiot. Let's do it this way. Client number two, you might need to caress a lot more. So when you are meeting somebody new or like starting to work with a new artist or producer or whatever, how quickly can you tell if there is going to be a good fit, or how quickly is it where you're like, oh, this is going to feel like a job today?
Usually once you get started, yeah, at least for me, I can tell, you know, just cause I've been doing it for a while. So, you know, I can kind of tell, like I'm very confident in my skills, so that's not going to get in the way of our relationship, you know, as an engineer artist. So it's really just more of a vibe thing. And you know, some people are just easier to work with. Some people really want to know, or really want things to be their way. And I mean, I think that's another skill as an engineer, is when to, when you can see that, you know. So I feel like I can go in and, you know, especially on recording sessions, and I can give a lot of feedback and almost be a producer on the song and really like guide them through things. And sometimes you gotta know when to shut the fuck up and chill and let them do their own thing. And sometimes it's somewhere in the middle. And that really just comes with experience and kind of being able to read people a little bit and read the situation. But ultimately, you know, I'm trying to set the best vibe for the artist. So if that means I'm very interactive and working with them, cool. If that means I'm just sitting there running Pro Tools and just operating, you know, that's cool too. So it's customer service industry. as an engineer. So it's really about the artists and, you know, best way to get the right vibe or the right, yeah, the right vibe for the song. So however that is to do it, you got to do it that way.
Yeah. Understand what they need, maybe anticipate their needs before them. We work with a lot of up and coming artists, obviously, who aren't signed to the labels and don't have all the tools like you have. When would you say is a good time? When does someone need to think about hiring someone in your role?
I mean, a good engineer is definitely going to help your song. You know, sonic wise, it'll kind of, I feel like it'll make the difference between an amateur sounding album and a pro sounding album. With that being said, you know, nowadays we have the tools, you can do stuff at home. So, you know, if you have a good ear and you know how to kind of tweak things the right way, like, you know, you can absolutely do it yourself. The other side of that, I feel like I've told artists this for years, you know, you as the artist, you've been living with this beat and writing vocals to it for, I don't know, a week, a month, 2 months, 6 months, however long. So you have a very like intimate relationship with this song. Me as the engineer, I'm coming in and probably never heard this before. So I can kind of take an outside look at the overall song and get a whole different perspective from it. And think of ideas possibly that you wouldn't have thought of because you've been living with this for so long. And, you know, it's fresh to me. And even songs that I've recorded and then also have to mix, I try and leave a lot of space in between the recording and the mixing if that's possible, because I don't want to get too stuck in the song. You know, the more I hear it, the more used to it I am. Because that first listen is always, you know, you come up with all these ideas and you don't want to lose that. So you got to try and separate that. So that can be a little tricky. I'm going off topic with the with the question, but yeah, no, I think having an engineer can be very helpful, you know, for mixing and for recording. I mean, even for recording, like if you know how to record yourself, that's great, and you know, save the money for sure. But you're also doing two jobs at once, and you can't necessarily always focus on the performance of your music. So sometimes even hiring an engineer, just so that you can be creative and not have to think of any of the technical stuff, is very helpful.
Well, I think you're totally right. And I think, so from the musician perspective, back in the day when before you and I started working together back in Boston, like I had a home studio and I was like, I considered myself an okay engineer, like until I met you. But so like, I was like, in the business side of like my musician head, I was like, well, you know what? In the long run, it will probably benefit me more if I can like build a home studio, have some equipment, and learn how to do this on my own. And to a point, that was correct. But you mentioned something important and what I didn't equate in my math, because I was only thinking dollars. I wasn't equating for time. And I might have spent 1 hour writing the song, hypothetically, and then maybe an hour recording it. But then I would spend 6, 8, 10 hours on mixing it down because, one, I'm the musician. I'm not an expert mixer, so I don't necessarily know what I'm doing. And I'm like, it can always be better. I don't know when this is done. So in my head, the reason because you and I work together on something like 20 songs, I bet. And the reason I kept paying for a top tier engineer was not only was my product so much better, but I saved 6 hours per song. And if I value my time at X dollars, even 20 bucks an hour, which would be like, if you're making a, you know, decent money, 20 bucks an hour isn't a lot. It's not nothing, but it's, so if I value my time at 20 bucks an hour and it takes me 6 hours to do like the mix, it's well worth, and I can only do it to a C+ level. It's way worth paying you like the 200 to get an A+ and save 6 hours. Cause maybe in that 6 hours, I could have written two more songs.
Right. Exactly. And I think that's absolutely right. Like, you know, on the short run, you can save a lot of money by, you know, recording at home and all that. But like you said, I mean, even me as a mixer, like, And I get to times where I'm like, I don't know, I can do more. But I also, with the experience, I've learned when, like, okay, this is where it needs to be. Like, you know, adding more is just, you're fighting against yourself, you know, at a certain point. Right. Yeah, absolutely. It saves time and all that and money.
Well, and I think just, yeah, it definitely is. And having the team, like, and also the networking, like, now here we are. Like, so yeah. Like, and one of the things I had a question for you was, once you went to LA and you went to Atlantic, and you start working with bigger artists who probably have like a system in place already. So like, sometimes like there might be like, and like NLE Choppa, I don't even know if I'm saying that name right. But like, right. So are there times where you are kind of just given a project on Pro Tools and someone says, hey, can you mix this? Like, are there big records or just good songs that you've been like, how many artists have you worked for that wouldn't know you? Like, if they were, you know, on the bus, like, oh, that's the guy who mixed my song, you know, like, is there a lot of that? Or are you always kind of working with the artists? Can you elaborate a little bit on the differences of the relationships?
Absolutely. As a mixer, like, if you're just a freelance mixer, you are rarely meeting the artist. Choppa, you know, I've been lucky to record him as well as mix him, so we've built a very good relationship. And we, you know, so we actually know each other, obviously. But yeah, a lot of the ASAP Rocky stuff I did, never met him. What else? Hunter Hayes, never met him. Did some stuff for LA Due, never met her. I even hit her up on IG one time, like, oh, I love working on your stuff. Never even heard back. She's like, who the fuck are you? Yeah, they don't know. So yeah, you're really just hired as a mixer, and you know, you might have a little bit of interaction with them. And if they're in town, I mean, that's the other thing is like, it, they might be on the other side of the country or the other side of the world. So you,
right.
And especially with the major label stuff, you're not really dealing with the artists. You're dealing more with the A&Rs, sometimes the producers. So they have people. The artist doesn't care. They just listen to it and want to, you know, hear if it sounds well, if it sounds good or not, you know.
Now, do you prefer it one way or the other? I guess in some ways it might be nice to just kind of be like, hey, you know, here, okay, I don't need to hear anything. I can sit and do this on my own time and mix and master it. Here you go, done. I only have to deal with one person. Or do you prefer kind of being really in the mix and really having your hands, like, when the hands on the project when they're making it?
Kind of both. I mean, you know, back when we used to work together in Boston, I used to, you know, mix everything right there on the spot. And, yep. You know, that, I feel like that forced me to move a little faster on the mix, which pros and cons to that. Now, since I'm sitting in my own studio mixing somebody's stuff without them here, I have a lot more free time, or not free time, but I have a lot more time to just spend as much time as I need on it. And there's the pros and cons with that as well. Obviously, I don't want to take too long, but I can also spend the time needed and not under these time constraints. When I first moved out here, I was just mixing. I hadn't done any recording sessions, or, you know, very few. And I started to miss being in the studio with the artists and being part of that creative process, and just, you know, felt antisocial, just stuck in my studio by myself all the time. So yeah, I kind of like both. But yeah, when it comes to mixing, I do, at least the beginning of the mix, I like to, you know, do on my own, because there's a lot of like cleanup stuff that might need to be done, things that I just don't need the artist there for. You know, I'm just trying to like get the 808 to sit right, and they're like, why do the vocals not sound right? I haven't even gotten to that yet, you know. So yeah, sometimes it's more beneficial not to have the artist there, at least for part of it. And that's how I work with Choppa. I record them, you know, I do a rough mix, you know, right there on the spot. Once it's ready to be mixed, I get all the stems, and then I spend time, you know, a few hours usually working on the song before he even takes a listen, send out a couple versions. He might give me some notes. And then sometimes he'll stop in the studio just to sit down with me and tweak a few things. So yeah, it's kind of good both ways, you know, with them or without them.
Now, when it comes to you getting paid, are you usually paid up front or do you take a percentage? Does it depend on what you're doing for the song? Some producers I know take upfront payment and percentage of 15, 20, 25%. What is a normal engineer's payment like for an artist?
For indie artists, that, you know, I still work with a bunch of indie artists. Unless, you know, I've built a relationship with them already, you know, I do try and get a deposit and at least get some of it up front. Especially like, you know, people hit me up on IG still and, you know, for mixes, like people I don't know. So, you know, just gotta, you know, it can be risky. But the label stuff, that's all like legit. So basically you get the mixes, send them out when you're done, do any updates that you need to, and then invoice them for it. And that could take some time to get paid for, but they pay you. So, and then, yeah, it varies. You know, obviously I can charge a lot more to the labels because they got a lot more money, and a little less to the indie artists, you know,
yeah,
trying to help people out. And, you know, there's a lot of good music, a lot of good artists that aren't signed to a major label and don't have that backing, that budget to pay, you know, a higher mix rate. but yeah, definitely it gets up there when you're with the labels. So, and then there's levels to that, you know, the big mixers that are out here charge thousands of dollars per mix and do like thousands of dollars per mix, you know, do them few a day, have, you know, assistants working for them. And, so yeah, it's definitely a lot of levels to it.
In terms of like your business, like your personal business, do you have kind of like a vision of where, of what you want? Do you want to kind of be like that kind of guy who has assistants, kind of like, do you want to have your own company and own like recording house, or are you like pumped to be where you're at and be an integral part of what's going on at this record label?
I mean, so I don't just work for Atlantic. As a mixer, I'm technically freelance. And since the whole quarantine started, they've kind of scaled back on the recording side of things. They have, you know, a bunch of studios here in Hollywood and they're not doing as much. So, you know, I work for all the different labels. So yeah, I am doing what I want to do, freelance mixer. I wouldn't, you know, I have my own little studio here in Hollywood and it's great. I don't do any recording here, but yeah, eventually I'd like to maybe have a studio where, you know, a specific mix room and as well as a recording room. And yeah, I mean, I do have an assistant now, just cause I've been so busy.
Hell yeah.
Recording all night long and then mixing all day long. So I need help to, like, you know, mix prep. And again, going back to what we spoke about earlier, the more you hear the song, the more involved you get with it. So, you know, if it takes me an hour or two to prep the mix, I've heard the song so many times at that point, so I lose my focus on it. So I hire somebody to kind of set it up the way I like. And yeah, you know, if it's a song that I recorded, you know, for a lot of the Choppa stuff, it's a lot easier to set up. But I do get sessions from other artists that, you know, I've never, you know, have other engineers and I've never seen the session before. And it just takes time to go through everything and organize it, get things color coded, you know, so that when I get to the mix, I can move as fast as possible. So yeah, having an assistant definitely helps. I don't have five assistants like other engineers, other mixers. Which
would be nice. One for each color code.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's like your story is really cool from like kind of like, cause I know you kind of started as like an apprentice somewhere, like, or right. Or were you just kind of
out here?
No, just like in general, like for what, like when you were getting started, like how did you end up getting into cyber sound? Like your dad was an engineer, right?
Yeah, like, my father's an engineer.
You kind of grew up around it. Awesome.
How did I get to cyber sound? I think when I was like 18, I started working for this DJ company in Boston and one of the other DJs worked there and he's like, oh, you trying to be an engineer. Let me hook you up over there. And yeah, I started interning. And before I finished school, I, you know, started engineering there, and that just kind of took off. So yeah, it just kind of knowing people, I think that's the best thing, you know, to be successful in our industry is relationships.
Big time.
Like, you can be the best person, the best engineer, the best artist, the best producer, the best whatever in the world, but if you don't know the right people or know somebody that knows the right people, it kind of doesn't matter, you know? Like, I was doing my thing in Boston. I had to come out to LA, where I knew some people, but not nearly as much as I did in Boston. And that was why it was kind of a slow start. But as I started meeting people, you know, things started taking off. And I mean, actually, that's how I got my job at Atlantic. One of my old interns at Cybersound, I randomly ran into him out here in Hollywood and exchanged numbers, never spoke again. One day he just randomly texted me. He's like, "You want a job at Atlantic?" Yes. And, you know, that's just kind of history. So be nice to your interns. Be nice to your runners.
Right. Well, and that's a good situation for him, because he probably looked good, right? He was like, "Oh, wait a minute. I might have an opportunity to look good to Atlantic because I can plug this guy in." He's like, "Shit, I know somebody who's really good who's out here." So that's not you exactly right. Well, I mean, it's really cool and to see like how far you've taken, kind of just something you saw your dad doing and like you were just around, and like then you're like, "Wait a minute, I kind of have my own business here." Now, was there a point where you were like, this is what I'm going to do? Or was it kind of just like you grew up watching your dad do it and you just never even thought about it? You kind of just did it.
Definitely wasn't trying to do what my father
did. So you were reluctant audio engineer.
Yeah. Well, as a kid, yeah, I wasn't planning on doing the same thing as him. I've been playing music since I was like 5 years old. I always wanted to do something in music, but I think, you know, throughout high school and, you know, just after high school, I wanted to be a producer. And then I just got into the studio and just fell in love with playing with all the toys on my own. And it just kind of went that way. You know, I do a lot of different music than my father. He does more jazz and classical, that type of stuff. I do more hip hop, pop, R&B stuff, more mainstream stuff. So yeah, it's definitely wasn't trying to follow in his steps, but it just kind of happened that way. And that's cool. We get to talk shop a lot, and you know, he's shown me things that, you know, he's learned over the last, I don't know, 25, 30 years engineering. And he hits me up sometimes and like, "So Aaron, how do you use this auto-tune thing?" It's like, "Yes, finally."
What is this Pro Tools?
Exactly.
Do they have amateur tools I can start with, or do I have to go pro?
Exactly. You gotta go pro, man.
You gotta go pro. And then they look it up, $300 for whatever. I don't even know how much it is now. What do you mean $300? $300 for Pro Tools. That's pretty funny. I mean, I'm sticking with my guns. I think you're top 1% of what you do. So we'll leave you here with a nice softball question. Ready? So what we're going to do is, it's almost Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to hear some of your best Halloween costumes. Like ever. That you've already worn. Not that you have for this year. Not an idea. Something you've already done. I feel like you could put together a hell of a Conor McGregor costume. For this year, if you're looking for an idea, you could do it. Get a bunch of fake tats, grow out the beard a little bit from here to Halloween. You got 2 weeks. You could do it.
Time, man. We can make it happen.
Do you have an Irish accent?
Do I have it? Nah, I'm terrible with accents. You got it though. I know.
I bet if you give me from now to Halloween, I could put one together.
I think you could. Yeah. Man, I don't know. I haven't dressed up in years. I end up working most of the time, to be honest. I can't even remember the last time I dressed up for Halloween. I don't know. It's a whack answer. But
I thought Elliot was going to ask you if he was in your top three ever recorded.
Yeah. Okay. So, but I do have a question though, because I remember, I bet there's one song you remember us recording, because it was, we were like, all right, man, so we're going to try something new. We don't know how it's going to go, but just bear with us and like, let us, and we did this like, this like wannabe like anthem, like halftime show song. And do you remember? You've done hundreds of songs. And if you remember this,
I do remember, I can't remember the name of it, but I do remember. Yeah,
it was like really heavy drums, boom, boom, go, go, boom, boom, go, go, boom, boom, go, go, boom, and then it was like, da, 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 da. Oh man, it was really bad. But we were like, oh dude, this could be like on Monday Night Countdown, like they could put this on ESPN or something, dude. I think it was called like Halftime Show or some shit. But like, so that just goes to show. And you don't remember it because it was an amazing song. You remember it because you're like, oh, what are these fucking guys doing?
As long as they pay me.
We had so much fun in the studio, though. We always had a good time. So.
Oh, we always had so much fun. And the best part about working with you is like if we ever like brought somebody with us, or like if somebody else was at the studio, like if they were like talking or like fucking dicking around in the studio, you would always be like, hey, yo, hey, can you shut the fuck up? And then they're all like, oh, that's right. Like, they take this shit serious. And I was like, thank good. I didn't need to say
work, man.
Yeah, right. I'm trying to fucking work. Take the goddamn conversation outside.
We got lounges for that.
Yeah, right. There's a couch out there if you want to gossip.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I still get that even out here. And people like to talk and bullshit. Sometimes I just throw headphones on at this point and say, fuck it, I'm not gonna yell at you anymore. I'm over it.
Right. It's like, yeah, hey, if you want to pay me for 6 hours of time and you want to dick around for two of them, it's on you. I'm getting paid the same either way.
Jim money.
Right. Well, yeah. Aaron, man, it's been great to like reconnect and chat with you about engineering. Yeah. And do you have like a website, or where should people reach out to you? Just on Instagram?
On Instagram, Aaron Mattis Mixing is my Instagram. And I did set up a website. It's have to work on it a little bit. It's not great. I'm working on it. But
all right.
But yeah, same thing. AaronMattisMixing.com.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, and the email, AaronMattisMixing@gmail.com. You can reach out to me for any of those spots, and I'd love to work with some of you.
Hell yeah. Well, he is my recommendation for an audio engineer. Aaron kills it. Dress up as Conor McGregor this year. I'll send you a thing of his whiskey. I've heard it's not that great, but I'll send you a fifth of it or something either way.
dress up as when you work. Hold my accent, everything.
Yeah. Do the accent when I'm working by myself.
Do it.
Pro Tools and Irish, Craig McGraw, whatever his name is, accent.
Right. I think you've got some potential there, man.
I'll try. Let me practice. I got a couple of weeks.
Right? You're right. You got 2 weeks.
All right.
Awesome, man. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time, bro. Aaron Mattis Mixing on Instagram. Reach out to him if you're looking for one of the best engineers there are, whatever. But thank you so much for your time, man.
Sure. Thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. We'll talk again soon.
All right, for sure. I'll talk to you soon, man.
Take care. See ya. Well, yep. He's a great guy. And he is, I think a good engineer has to be super meticulous and super into the details. And that is what makes him really good. On top of that is the speed in which he can do it.
And the people he can put up with.
Yes, I am sure that is a tricky scenario, because a lot of artists will pay good money to go to a good studio, but that doesn't mean that they know what they're doing. And it must be tough to walk that line of being like, look, man, like, you're trying to do this, but like, it really should be this way. Cause the thing is with like music, certain songs, like music has a natural flow. It's like almost like Sometimes it's like math. Like if the math doesn't line up, the equation is wrong. And that's kind of where engineer meets producer, where it's like, no, we need to change the structure of this song, or we need to do that. Like mixing is just, oh, you've got this song down. It's recorded. Let me mix it. He kind of does both, and he's really, really good at it. I think it's a good example of, you know, is it worth getting, you know, what does a good engineer entail? Is it worth it for me? I think if you're at the point where you kind of understand where your music business is at and you're looking to say, how can I take my product to the next level? If you aren't looking at a professional engineer, that might be the next way to go. Maybe the casual listener doesn't see the difference in the file, but people in the industry do. People who know what they're doing do. And if that great mix can take a song from a B plus to an A minus, that could change your career. Really. But all right. Lots of talking from me again. What do you want to leave them with?
I thought that was a good ending point. I've got nothing to add to that. You've done it more than I have. And I mean, I guess if any artist is suspicious, no, that's not the word I want. If they're questioning the benefit, skeptical, that's it. If you think that you can do it the best, you can't, and you should at least give someone else a try, even if it's just once. And even if you think you were just as good, other people won't agree. Like Aaron said, you get so involved with that song, you're into it too much. You can love a song because you put so much time and effort into it. There's a lot of psychology out there based on anything. If you put time and effort into anything, you're going to support that and defend that thing more than another person would. You'd be more hesitant to make changes to that thing. Elliot and I talk a lot about even just radio edits, asking people to cut down an intro, and people don't want to because they're obsessed with it. But ultimately, if it's someone else needs to come in and tell you that, or else you won't be able to take that next step. And if you ever do find a manager or a label who wants to work with you, they're not going to want to work with you for long if you're not willing to at least listen to other people's advice.
Right. And I think you can know your song better than anybody, but, or the idea of your song. I think a lot of musicians might be like, well, I know my idea better than anybody. True. But this engineer, a good engineer, will likely know how to make your idea sound the best it possibly can. And a good engineer doesn't necessarily go in and fuck around with the structure of your song or the words. They just want to make sure that the beat and the words go together and sounds good on a phone and a computer and your headphones and a car. It's very important. And I mean, he's top of the line, and he's like $250, I think, for like a mix and a master.
I'm sure it's more now.
It might be more now, but when I was doing it, it was like $200, and he's top of the line. So get like you can get a B plus engineer for $150. I'm telling you right now, your money is better spent on getting 8 great sounding songs over 15 that you did on your own. I'm telling you, I did it myself. I had to swallow that like little bit. I don't even know if it was pride. I was just caught in my ways. I thought I was doing the right thing, but there are like, as the musician, it's great if you can mix and master your own stuff. But like really, like as the musician, like you want to be the creative, you want to be making the song, not spending your hours editing it.
Like you said at the beginning, it's not about getting them to listen once. It's getting them to listen a second time. And you can market the hell of a song, but if it's not good and right. It could have been better, you know, even it can be good, but it can be better. And for example, if someone hears it in their car compared to their headphones the first time and it's not impressive, they're not going to give it a chance on their headphones. Or right. They hear it on their headphones like, ooh, let me hear this in my car and let me hear it. And it is off. That's it. you've pretty much sunk your marketing money and just wasted it. Because you got those ears on it, but they didn't give it that second opportunity.
Well, you just said something key where it's like, oh yeah, it's good, but it could have sounded better. That's what irritates me now. Because I listened to records that I did back 5 years ago now. And knowing what I know now, I know they could have sounded so much better. And I wasn't thinking about, my fans, the people I have already, they don't care. They like me. They see the idea. I wasn't thinking of, what if this song finds somebody in Chicago that doesn't know me for the very first time? What are they going to think? What is a record label? What if the president of Interscope happens to hear this song and they can tell that I recorded it in my basement using GarageBand with a mic like this? Even the thing is, there's a point, right? Okay, you can see the talent, no doubt, but like the quality of the product is so important. I don't care how good your logo is on that hoodie. If that hoodie fits weird or it shrinks after the first time, I don't care how good the logo looks. It's kind of similar.
I agree.
Okay, so if you are interested in learning more about this, subscribe to our YouTube channel. Find us on Instagram and sign up for our newsletter so you can get more information about this. Follow Aaron Mattis Mixing on Instagram and reach out to aaronmattismixing.com so you can find a professional audio engineer, or I'm sure he'll give you some pointers as well. But yeah, I think this was a great podcast, definitely worth us coming on late and getting a beer or two, talking to a professional audio engineer over at Atlantic Records in Los Angeles. My name is Elliot. That's James. This has been the Business of Music podcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Business of Music podcast. We love to hear feedback. Shoot us an email to contact@denovoagency.com so we can answer your questions on the next episode. Be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel to learn even more, and check out denovoagency.com to see how we can help you grow your music business. Until next time, this has been the Business of Music podcast.